This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for downloading this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, coming to you from a rather wet and slightly snowy Aberdeenshire at the moment. With me about 40 miles to the north in his home, Ewan McElraith.
Yeah, it's one of those strange days in January where it can't quite make up its mind. It's snowing one minute, it's sleet the next, it's rain the next. And it can get you down, but I've been out walking the dog. I mean, you get really wrapped up and you get out there and the wind's blowing in your face and you come back to a log fire. And I'm watching two red squirrels working their way through 10 kilograms of peanuts at the moment. No idea where they're burying them. But, you know, it's just a time to embrace it. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, I must go. My fire went on about 3 or 4 hours ago. And you will have nice rustic logs. I'm burning what's left of my porch. It produces heat. I don't care.
The great smell of burning paint.
You betcha. As you know, we always like to hear from the folk that download the podcasts. And we like to hear where you listen to the podcasts. We were extremely cheered recently to receive an email from Professor Alison Phillips, who's the UNESCO Chair for Refugee and Integration Through Languages and the Arts based at the University of Glasgow, where she teaches languages and intercultural studies.
Yeah, Alison got in touch to tell us about World Radio Day, and she's been asked by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organisation to nominate her favourite radio show. And she chose us, and we were flattered.
Yeah, it's not just a case of having our egos massaged, although that's always a wonderful thing. We were genuinely curious to find out more about the work that Alison does and how our interests in the natural world, things like storytelling, sound, folklore, food and so on, is important within the context of her work. So, Alison, welcome to the podcast. I'm going to ask you to do something very difficult for a start. You have to share your mihi with us. Tell us what a mihi is and then do it.
A mihi is a way of greeting that Māori in Aotearoa, New Zealand use. It's really like doing political diplomacy. So when you meet people you don't know, it's how you introduce yourself to them and you give lots of different facets of yourself. So you might say what your local mountain is or your local river or the canoe you have arrived on, and then who your parents, grandparents, and what your genealogy is. And it's a way of giving people a way of connecting to more than just the person who's standing there. I'm going to share the mihi that I was encouraged to write by Māori in Aotearoa, New Zealand, as a way of placing myself in their world and in my own world in Scotland. I was born in Sheffield, the UK, a product of the new welfare state to teachers. The hills I loved were Culwark, Higatour and Stanage Edge. The rivers flowed through Watercombe Jollydale. In my genealogy, there are no settlers that I can find, nor in my family, just farmers, butchers, weavers, and the legacies of a dislocating modernity in the north of England. Grandma and Grandpa Blackburn took in strangers, the new immigrants brought from the Indian subcontinent to work the mills of Lancashire. And they took in refugees, those escaping from the Prague Spring, and they helped them find an occupation. Grandma and Grandpa Mairam took me to feed chickens, pigs and sheep in my red wellies before feeding the village. I grew up in the cauldron of rage, which was Margaret Thatcher's destruction of the hope in my city as she closed the mines, the steelworks and the rates of suicide increased in my school. I became a traveller, a Roma woman selling clothes pegs at my door when my mother was carrying me still unborn, said I would. My father taught me the names of the hills, flowers, trees and birds. My mother taught me to bake and to listen in hard to words. Music made me laugh and learn. A politics took root. I've never been to Soweto, but it shaped the inner landscape of my youthful soul. Languages opened me out. Anthropology and folklore worked, giving structure to my thoughts. Theatre, liturgy and poetry gave them form. Offenburg, St. Pochère, Durham, Biberach, Clermont, Tübingen, Hyingen, Hornberg, Tézé. I married Robert and we took work in Scotland, in Glasgow, a city that was home from home. And the hills became Ben Skriel, Brariach, Ben Aglo, and I dangle my feet in the cold waters of Glentilt and swim in Martyrs Bay on the Isle of Iona. The university became my occupation, and its books and teachings changed my life and sent me back out into the world, a vessel for grief, a vulnerable observer, a witness with words, back to learn again the lessons of hospitality of my ancestors. I often choked with shame at what has been done by the crown through history in my name. Syria, Palestine, Gaza, South Africa, Malawi, Sudan, Ethiopia, Jamaica, Jordan, Egypt, Aboriginal Australia, Indigenous Canada, Zimbabwe, Malaysia, the Gaeltacht, Aotearoa New Zealand. I once read the Freedom Charter aloud from the Rivonia cell walls, and everywhere, land, stone, and a meshwork of love and anger. With the years and struggles comes the love of silence and solitude. I once crossed Tongariro, climbed Malanje, Skidder and Scarfell Pike. I've worn out my shoes with walking and standing firm. I'm English, Scottish, Halbschwaben and Bilen. I became poet, gardener, lover, foster mother, bread maker, piper, wool worker, and at times a person who prays. My friend Piki took me to Te Oruwera. I listened to the forest there through the bushmen on the ridge. I slept deeply, bright with stars. I think there is now a moko in the corner of my soul. I am Alison.
That is lovely. What an excellent idea that is, Ewan, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm just going to gobsmack. That's sitting down to write that, you know, distilling your life into 3 or 4 minutes must be a challenge, but it's a great way to break the ice and so much more effective than, hi, I'm Ewan. Because, yeah, there's just that whole background. It's a great idea. The World Radio Day, UNESCO Day event, what is it about? What's the history of it?
This year, radio is 110 years old, and World Radio itself is 10 years old as a day. So the history really is just celebrating the way that radio has done so much for innovation and for connection. But also with the work I've been doing with the UNESCO National Commission in the UK, thinking about the way that radio is very different to social media. Social media kind of manages you with its algorithms, whereas radio has, you know, people like Helen who are doing the producing of it and thinking differently about how to put things together. So it accompanies your life in a very different way. And in a way, you know, very much I found with your radio program. So when I was invited to kind of name, it was a bit of a surprise in an interview I was doing, but invited to name my favorite radio show, it was just really easy. And I realized that, you know, over the last 10 years for myself, your show has been a kind of regular soundtrack to my life. You know, I will wake regular as clockwork on a Saturday morning and switch on the radio and there are your voices. And then as my work has taken root and I've been traveling so much, I'd download your show onto my phone before I went. So you were kind of there with my passport. And I'd often be really jet lagged or the work I'd be doing was really stressful and would be keeping me awake and I'd be anxious. And I found if I switched on the podcast and listened to it in the wee small hours, you were kind of my answer to what to do if you're having trouble sleeping, which may not sound like a compliment.
Thank you.
But is that actually there was just something so soothing about the voices, the sounds of home, places I might have visited or places I might want to visit, just coming into my imagination again or into my memory again. And the way that you would be just interviewing all kinds of people, you know, from people who'd taken exile within Scotland to people who'd brought all kinds of innovations. And I'd just been listening to that lovely programme you did on wassail and thinking about that as a tradition that I'd experienced in South Yorkshire, the wassailing, the carols around the pubs that we used to do, the kinds of things that Kate Rusby, the folk singer, has sung about in the past, and that was very much part of my youth growing up. So just was really excited to hear about the wassailing traditions coming up to Scotland from England and enriching, you know, the way we grow apples and the way we celebrate in the darkest months of the year.
Yeah. Genuinely gratified that you enjoy the programme and you know, very honoured that you chose us. But there was a phrase in your mihi that kind of jumped out at me, vulnerable observer. That, you know, the world you are frequenting, the world you have chosen to so try and assist is not an easy one.
Glasgow is this extraordinary city of welcome, of asylum, of dispersal. You know, it's been for the last nearly 20 years the number one city for asylum dispersal in the UK. And so you can't really help live in the city without seeing how that's changed what the city is and seeing how it's brought out and drawn out strands of hospitality and of activism, and particularly under COVID, of care. And that you go in a way then from, you know, yes, a vulnerable observer, somebody watching things happening in your city that you don't rightly understand, or listening to sounds of languages or patterns of cultural behaviour that you don't rightly recognise, that don't feel familiar. And then gradually over time, they become much more familiar to you. And you also then see the way that that's been a similar journey for others. So as you come into relationship and friendship with refugees and asylum seekers, you realise just how bizarre the things are that we do and how peculiar are our traditions. And yet that this extraordinary diversity that is made out of food and land and language all over the world becomes something that's a point of reference to us. I mean, I was just thinking and chatting a little with Helen before the show about the last week that has just been this absolutely mesmerizing adventure on Zoom for me of attending virtual burn suppers organized by the various refugee and asylum groups in Glasgow, and having, you know, hundreds of refugees and asylum seekers on a Zoom call with, you know, local politicians and local artists, basically making the tradition and pattern that is a burn supper their own. And so I've, you know, watched people making a Syrian haggis this week, and I've been introduced to someone playing what I thought was a sitar but turned out to be something called a rhubarb, which is an Afghan instrument. I think all of these areas, you are a vulnerable observer because you're about to enter into a world you don't understand, but equally you're doing it with people who've entered into worlds that you inhabit that they don't rightly understand, and together you're sort of making something new. We found, particularly when we've been doing research with refugees and also with the communities into which they've integrated and who've been integrating into the lives of the refugees as well, because it's always much more than a one-way process. People come and they like the friendliness. They like the fact that there are multiple accents of English here, because they often come with multiple languages themselves. And so that feels familiar. They like the kind of in-your-face friendliness, even the slightly gallousness, I think, of Glasgow. They will moan about the weather and learn to do that very quickly. And again, I've heard asylum seekers and refugees and members of the global diaspora and international students say to me, they love the fact that they can be standing in the pouring rain at a bus stop in Glasgow, and the person standing with them will speak to them and will call them son, or will call them love, or will call them daughter. And they've often said to me, what a beautiful phrase that is when they're feeling lonely and afraid and a bit lost, that suddenly here's somebody who's talking to them as if they're family. And that's helped them understand that phrase, you know, we're all Jock Sampson's bairns.
But it's not just a rainy bus stop in Glasgow, is it? You're taking your refugees to very different parts of Scotland, different experiences, different cultural events.
There's something really lovely about watching something unfold from a moment of encounter to being alongside people as they begin to recover and make a home again. So there's lots of different things we've been doing within the UNESCO chair team, but also many of my colleagues in the city of Glasgow have been involved in, and that we've been involved in my family as well, because our foster daughter was an unaccompanied minor. I mean, she's now grown up with her kids of her own, our foster grandkids. But I remember her being taken away as part of a programme from what was then Annie's Lane College up to Camas on the Ross of Mull, which is an outdoor activities centre run by the Iona community. And you know, these wonderful moments and stories that she told us when she came back, you know, and she was just bright with life and also the kinds of sleeplessness that, you know, 16, 17-year-olds will come back home with after they've been away with their mates on a school trip or a college trip. But there were lovely things that happened there where they were walking down the track to Camas, which is this beautiful bay on the Ross of Mull. And to get there, you've got to carry all your stuff or push it with a wheelbarrow down the track for about a mile and a half. And they had good weather. It was May and they had good weather and they were pushing stuff down the track. And then suddenly somebody heard the sound of a chicken and they just dropped the wheelbarrow and ran down the track because the sound of a chicken was the sound of home, and home was the Sudan, and chickens were what they had in the yard at home before this person had had to flee. And there's something there about these almost universal connections to the sounds of farming or the sounds of nature or the connections with the land you really feel when you take people out of the city, and that people will recognise what a city is. They'll often have been living for a while whilst waiting to move on in refugee camps or in quite dense urban areas in cities around the world like Khartoum or like Kampala or like Addis Ababa. There is this connection to what was part of what made the food, what was part of what made a feast. So I remember in our family, we got to find my daughter's family again after a long search, after their separation. And they were living in Khartoum at the time. And we were able to go and join them for their Christmas, which is the Christmas in the Orthodox Christian calendar. So it takes place around about our Epiphany, 7th of January. And just learning there that, you know, what happens is you will kill a sheep and you will eat a sheep on that day. And that then connected me to all the stories of when I was five, you know, sitting watching my grandfather slaughtering sheep and teaching me how to do it and teaching me how to salt a fleece and lay it out, you know, with those red wellies in the yard at the butcher's shop and on the small holding where he lived. So there's all these ways in which nature connects and the land connects and agriculture connects. And watching that come alive in people and seeing people feel at home is just a really lovely thing. And many of the integration projects we have in Glasgow and across Scotland, but also ones I've seen around the world, when I visit them, in a way, they're all the same. They all will have a community garden. They'll all have a place where people can roll up their sleeves and learn about how the earth works in the new place that they're living. And this will often be a place of real trial and error and experimentation, and that people will want to try and grow sweet potatoes in parts of Scotland where that's really going to be very challenging. Or they'll want to know if a date tree might grow, or they could grow bananas. And gradually they'll learn, you know, what does grow and be really good at it, be really good at hoeing weeds and caring for the land, because they've got a tradition that might have been interrupted, but then is restored to them through those connections.
How important is it to get out of Glasgow? Because as you said, many of these refugees aren't from cities. What's it like taking somebody up their first Monroe if they're arriving in Scotland as a refugee?
I mean, it's magical. It's also quite funny because I've certainly found with people out that we've done this with from the Horn of Africa, there's quite a bit of work to be done to persuade people about that the ground will be very, very wet. And that really you will need several layers, and a pair of gloves would be a good idea. So there's all those things that are about living in a temperate maritime climate, which tends, particularly on the west coast of Scotland, to be damp. And we've got all of these, you know, kind of Instagram shots of, you know, members of the family and our foster family, standing on top of the cobbler and watching them, you know, super fit, really putting us to shame. And I mean, I know doing this with my daughter, she used to run for an hour every day back home in Eritrea before school, you know, at altitude. So all those, you know, myths and legends we have of runners from the Horn of Africa who can, you know, smash all the records in a marathon or in the Olympics, you know, we've been living with that kind of lung capacity in our household. And just seeing these pictures of people posing on top of these rocks in Scotland, you know, kind of doing a Titanic-style pose, you kind of see people in a moment of unadulterated joy in a landscape that they're part of too. And I think there's something about those images and those experiences have taken people up the mountains after we've managed to wrestle people into a good stout pair of shoes that is absolutely wonderful.
You spent time in New Zealand. What did you learn about how they interact with the land there?
I mean, I've been back from 8 months in New Zealand and several visits before that, just at the start of March 2020. And I was a visiting professor at Otago University in Otipoti, Dunedin. And I think one of the really interesting things I learned there was the way that Kiwis were trying to learn to live in an uneasy and difficult and steady reconciling relationship with what the settler colonial past had been and what the indigenous Māori past had been and what an interweaving might look like in the present. That was really very much about understanding what it means to try and live in a way that honours the Treaty of Waitangi. So the Treaty of Waitangi is this document that was signed by some of the Māori chiefs in Te Reo Māori, the language of the Māori, and in a different translation by the settler colonial powers as part of a peace treaty in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And for many, many decades, this treaty wasn't really honoured. But over the last 10 years, there's been a process of trying to honour that treaty, to understand together and with great difficulty what it might mean to try and honour that treaty. And this is not a simple, happy process. It's very fraught at times, quite a queasy process, quite a difficult process for those of Pākehā, of settler colonial background, and for visitors like myself from one of the countries that was ascending country of immigrants to New Zealand. I remember first meeting a Māori bushman in the Orawaras, and he just, after I'd done my mihi, after I'd explained to him who I was and what my mountain and my river and my canoe was, which happened to be a particular aircraft, he said, "Do you know, when you people first came over, we called you refugees because they showed us the pictures of the Gorbals in Glasgow that you'd all come from and you were refugees." And that opened out into really quite a rich conversation about a concept of manaakitanga, which is the Māori word, manaakitanga, for hospitality. It's a word which is a duty which many, many Indigenous cultures, including those of our own within Scotland, feel are vital. You know, we've got so many traditions in our folklore of the way in which we give and offer hospitality and which are there in our myths and legends. I mean, I'm just thinking it's coming up to the feast of St. Bride, of Bridget's Day, Brige, the patron saint of the Hebrides and of fostership, you know, and the stories of her welcoming with a cross of rushes, or, you know, the stories of her as a foster mother and the legends of her. You know, so we have our own. And it was really as I was learning those traditions that there are of hospitality and how it is to be performed and how it is not wrong initially to treat a stranger with a degree of caution, as what the poet David Wagner has called as a powerful stranger who might make you feel lost, that there's a real wisdom in that. So in not rushing headlong into we'll welcome everybody regardless, but also in not going we won't welcome anyone, we'll be really suspicious, we need everything for ourselves, but actually in taking time to step gradually towards the other, to learn about the other, to allow that to be a process that takes time. And one of the things, particularly in parts of Aotearoa New Zealand that I was witnessing, was the way that the Crown had come to settlements with Māori that meant that the land was given back to particular Māori groups, Māori iwi or Māori tribes, for their stewardship, with financial settlement too. And that meant that, for example, the land of the Orawaras, which had been held by the Department of Conservation, lapsed from being stewarded by the Department of Conservation and by the Crown, and was returned to the stewardship of Māori to steward in the way that they wished to. And that has then led to the work that's gone on to recognise the land as having a legal personality and of the need for Māori for human beings, for visitors to that area of New Zealand and to New Zealand itself, to exercise what's called kaitiaki, which means a care for the landscape, an understanding of almost a human ecology that means that the land must be respected, its rights as a living, breathing, growing entity should be taken into account. And for me, that was something I brought back and thought, gosh, what would that look like in Scotland if we granted legal personality to, you know, the remnants of the Caledonian rainforest, for example, or to particular mountains or particular areas, to geoparks, to places like St Kilda? What would that look like? And that would take on even further the cultural and environmental justice work that UNESCO does with its World Cultural Heritage sites and with its geoparks and with sites of special scientific interest and with our own national parks, which are often geared towards an economic or a tourism interest. So I came back with lots of thoughts and ideas, which are, you know, obviously part of my job to think with and about, but were about offering a refuge as well to the land. But in many ways, you know, some of the ways in which we've treated the land, you know, clambered over it, ploughed it up, raped and pillaged it, scorched the earth. You know, some of the ways we've behaved and the metaphors we've used towards the land are not unlike some of the ways we've behaved towards women and children who've sought refuge, and that there might be something about considering giving refuge to the land, giving the land a break too, in the way that we give people a break and watch them rewild themselves, return. I know it's a problematic term, but return to a state of being that maybe is just more soothing, is gentler, is less driven by the algorithms, and maybe a little more like the rhythms that I find, the serenity that I can find in listening to your voices on a Saturday morning or in the small hours of the morning when I'll be lulled to sleep.
Well, and we're just listening to some of these ideas and I'm just drinking them in. There's so much that we could take from that, especially giving that the land a break. But if I can take you back to the refugees that you've been working with, we've talked a lot in this programme over months and years about the healing powers of nature, especially mentally during this pandemic. You mentioned Bride or Bridget, the Feast of Bridget, getting out and cutting the reeds and forming that into that intricate bride's cross, that you're interacting with nature and interacting with your past and your history and your family and your friends. But what role does that interaction with nature have to do with healing the type of trauma that the refugees you're working with are seriously suffering from?
There's something I think about the land and working the land or being in a garden and working with a garden. It's almost a flow experience. You know, there's been lots of psychological research done on states of happiness or states of wellness and the kinds of activities where you can get into a flow, where there's a organic connection between the rhythms of your body and the rhythms of your mind and the rhythms of your emotion, and you can just be in the moment. And I think, you know, watching people and being with people, you know, their breath laboring, climbing up a mountain or messing about on a river in a boat or digging a garden, watching the kind of, you know, some of my refugee family will come up to my allotment and it's just magnificent. You know, suddenly there we are. And stories that I will always hesitate to ask anyone to tell me their story. Stories are sacred. They are precious and they are hard to tell for people. And I've learned this over the years that I don't ask people to give an account of themselves to me, particularly as in the legal process of refugee recognition, people have to give an account of themselves to people who distrust that account by profession. You know, lawyers or officials in immigration departments the world over, they're used to telling the same story again and again and again and it not being trusted. So I've learned not to ask, so where are you from? Not to say, what was your story? Not to ask what the journey was like? Not to ask what they're missing from home? You know, at the moment, we're asking everybody what they're missing under lockdown. And, you know, people just well up in tears. It's a hard, hard question because we're missing things so much. And that's like asking people who are of refugee background, you know, what do you miss from home? You know, it's inaccessible. People cannot return to those countries without jeopardizing their status. And What does it mean to be in a different place where the stories just suddenly start to flow? And so I can be, you know, turning the compost bin with a friend, or, you know, some of my PhD students who are refugee background, they'll beg me to come and spend some time up on the plot and planting potatoes with me. And they'll laugh and go, oh, we don't plant it like this, we plant it like that. And then they'll start to show me how they plant. And then the stories come. And the stories will come about planting potatoes back home. Or I remember being with a Kenyan who was staying with us for a while, who had come out of a very tricky political situation where he'd been standing for election. He'd been under house arrest. It'd been a very violent time. And he came over to the plot with me, and it was September. And I had, fool that I am, had a go at growing sweet corn that year, corn on the cob. And I'd got like four, it was a good year, and I'd got these four greening, spindly corn on the cobs that I had carefully tended all year. And literally, I mean, the minute he arrived there, he burst out laughing at my corn on the cob. And he then started to tell me about the corn on the cob back home, and, you know, how big it was and how juicy it was and what you did with it and how you cooked it and how delicious it was and how sweet it was and what the festivals were and how, you know, in their tradition, the maize was a symbol of life and maize corn that was held in the palm of the creator. And there were these lovely stories just flowing out that were about the land and the folklore of the time. But there was something else I realised in that moment, which was about dignity and about equality. So no longer was I in these positions that so often I am, as the person with secure immigration status, the person with citizenship, the person with a secure job, the person who's a professor, all these things that I might be in the first encounter with me as a stranger. But I was this really not very good gardener who couldn't grow corn on the cob. And here he was, his dignity as a gardener, as a farmer, as a person with tradition, as an indigenous person himself, not someone of refugee background. Here he was connecting back and showing me, teaching me in a very similar way to the way that many of the elders on the allotment will teach me. You know, they'll come over and see my rhubarb is struggling, and they'll tell me what I've done wrong, and they'll set me right, and then they'll tell me stories about how they've been set right themselves. So I think there's something very, very important in the way that nature can act as a leveler, as a third term, in the way that we have to get down on our knees to dig the ground, and we all have to do that. We all have to have backbreaking work, the way that to climb a hill you have to puff and pant, and therefore you're all kind of connected to the one breath and to the one body in that way. And that's where those stories can come, and they come in safety because we're connected in a way that isn't about you tell me your story but I'll never tell you mine, and that will be a point of superiority or domination, but rather they can come as part of that accompaniment. That's not unlike that tricky process that I was talking about earlier in Aotearoa, New Zealand, of the accompaniments of trying to learn to live together when much wrong has been done and when many of the hurts cannot and possibly should not be spoken of until we've built a container of the self that is strong enough to hold the hurt that has been done to us through no fault of our own.
You'd never know it by looking at us, but both Ewan and I love food. You know, obviously we're like racing snakes, really. We cook up the bacon on the fire pit every Saturday morning, that kind of thing. How significant is food within cultural integration?
Well, I have to say, I mean, for me, those moments where I know that you're cooking up food outside and it's pouring with rain and you're both moaning, I mean, they integrate me back into, you know, campsites of my childhood where we were desperately struggling to try and get a fire to light. So many of the places I've visited in the world for my work have the hearth and the fire and the place of cooking at the very heart of the home, particularly the making of bread or whatever the staple is. Just thinking about being welcomed into an Indigenous family in Zimbabwe. Yeah, absolutely jet-lagged out of my head. I'd been travelling for 22 hours. I've just been standing for 3.5 hours in immigration. I'm desperate for a shower and some and a drink. And I'm whisked away immediately to be given a proper welcome. And it's, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning by the time I get there, and I walk into a room and there's a massive table full of food, and, you know, it's sadza, and that is the maize meal, the equivalent of bread, the maize meal bowls of porridge, and there I am, and they've, you know, they've killed the chicken, and there are eggs in the stew, and, you know, it's that old story of hospitality, isn't it? You know, the killing of the fatted calf. And here are people giving of what they have, the best of what they have, signifying a feast that tells them that somebody is joining them as a guest and that this person needs protection extending to them. And so cookery and cooking the fruits of the earth and celebrating that is a big part of the work of Integration Networks, big part of the work of Refugee Festival. I was chatting once with Selena Hales, who runs Refugeegee.
Yes, I met her.
And I remember her just saying, you know, for every event we do, you need food and you need music. You need to sit, if you can, sit around a fire or a barbecue, and you need food and you need music. And I remember, I mean, Sabir Zazai as well, who is the CEO of Scottish Refugee Council, came from Afghanistan in the back of a lorry. And the University of Glasgow recently honoured him with an honorary doctorate. And his father was able to come over from Afghanistan. Afterwards, he invited myself and members of my family, but also the 7 members of a family of friends had come to stay with us to come over for a barbecue. And I'll just never forget it. You know, effortlessly, they were cooking a meal, an hour's notice for 15 people. There was a barbecue in the back garden, and there they were with these extraordinary skewers in the middle of June, you know, the smoke wafting off the midges. And, you know, I mean, I've never seen so much food. And, you know, every time I turned my back, my plate was full of, you know, delicious scented rice and grated carrot and salads and these extraordinary sweet meats and just beautiful food and Afghan tea. And these are just unforgettable moments. And I just think there's something about the way that food levels and food invites, that the smells invite, that, you know, when you smell certain things, they speak to you.
Coffee, for example.
Bacon in particular.
Bacon, yes, but it means freshly ground coffee, that kind of thing, you know, made in those little pots and things. I put a foot seriously wrong in Ethiopia when I was offered coffee, and I didn't drink coffee at the time. And I should have drunk the coffee.
Yeah, and I mean, within our family now, yeah, Eritrean coffee is just a normal thing. It's how you have coffee. But it actually takes nearly 3 hours. And to do it properly, according to all the rituals, is a really significant thing. And I remember when my foster daughter had our first grandchild, she'd been off for a walk with the pram outside. We were looking after her at home, as is the tradition for a Belen Eritrean family. That's what you would do. And I just realised that she'd not yet really had an experience of home. So I went and put on the Zoria, the dress, the traditional dress that is the dress of a Belen woman from Eritrea, from her ethnic group in Eritrea, and then began to cook coffee with the coffee set and put on the incense to smoke. And when she came back with our granddaughter, and she came in, the look on her face, you know, looking at me through the haze of smoke, and she just said, "Oh, Alison, I'm home." And it's like that doubling of home that comes with particular scents, the smells of food cooking, but also the smells of nature. You know, there's a particular smell that I have when I come back from my travels that I get only on the allotment. You know, it's almost like I'm hefted to that land in the way that the sheep are. And when, you know, there's a time of year in March where the earth just has a particular smell and a loaminess to it that is entrancing. And I see the way that that also happens, that fuses us at really quite a visceral level. And it's why food is at the heart of hospitality and the way we offer it. And that all these amazing new ways we learn to make food together when we cook together in combinations that we've never known before. I remember trying to make injera, that amazing Ethiopian Eritrean pancake that is what all food is wrapped in that part of the world. And, you know, in the first few months of my foster daughter being with us, you know, trying to do this as a very clumsy, cack-handed way of making home. And she was in fits laughing. And it's now just a story in our house of, well, Alison can make injera, but its eyes are closed because it's meant to be full of a kind of fermenting liquid where its eyes are open. But you know, my injera can't see, its eyes are closed. And this just being a joke, you know, it's just a lovely way of doing integration for me being integrated into that household, the need for humour. You know, one of my friends who's a psychotherapist who's done lots of work with refugees and asylum seekers, but also those people like myself, people who've ended up with some degree of secondary trauma through holding and listening and living with these stories ourselves. And she says, you know, we can't change anything without humour, without laughter, without being able to not take ourselves too seriously and not be taken too seriously as well. And so, you know, when I think about my Kenyan friend on the allotment and my foster daughter laughing at me because I can't get my injera to open its eyes, these are all ways in which we learn to integrate into something new that we make together as human society. And for me, that's at the heart of integration, not burdening refugees who've already had so much they've gone through with yet another set of tasks of, you know, get a job, learn a language, be like us, forget your home, you know, do it all this way, fill in these forms, you know, these kind of very harsh ways that sometimes the state can try and require integration. But actually that softness that is the fun of making a meal together on a fire, or the dignifying other people with the right to welcome us into their homes, into their food, around their tables, into their stories of climbing the first mountains, or what the mountains are like back home, or what the land was that their ancestors had, or why milk is a really important thing for them to drink, and how the milk comes to them and what kind of vessels it's carried in. And that it's in those places, I mean, a bit like where I started, when you speak of your local mountain or your local river, or you say, you know, my grandfather was a butcher and my grandmother used to make clothes, that those are things that make us human and that we can connect to in a much deeper way than have you filled out your form, or did you tick the right box on an immigration form, or, you know, did you turn up at the right time to your interview, when time has very different meanings for people in different parts of the world as well.
Alison, this has been a real privilege. Ewan put it well earlier. There's a lot of ideas come out of this that are new to us, but, you know, that we have every intention, I would imagine, of following up. It's been a real eye-opener, Ewan.
It's been great. We've been talking for an hour, and I could easily do another 2 hours. It's been absolutely wonderful, Alison, and great food for thought, and just wonderful to know that you're giving a wee bit back to people who really need it.
Thank you also, Alison, for nominating us as your choice for World Radio Day. It is humbling. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for all the work that you do.
Work?
Work? Question mark. Exactly. Please get in touch with us, as Alison did. Tell us where you listen to this podcast. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Ewan McElraith, the rather wonderful Alison Phipps, and producer Helen Needham. Thanks for listening.